Sai's Glory, His Divine Story. Every Thursday on Morning Glory. Catch the vibe with me, Karuna Munshi, on Radio Sai's Thursday Live on Asia Stream at 9:40 a.m.
Tune in to Sai.
Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m.
on Radio Sai's Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Stay tuned.
A very warm Om Shri Sai Ram, good morning, bonjour and hola to Radio Sai listeners all over the globe. Dear brothers and sisters, thank you ever so much for tuning in to the divine vibe of Prashanti Nilayam India, the spiritual epicenter of the cosmos, where the countdown has begun for the most organic, spiritually charged and multinational Christmas celebrations. My name is Karuna and this episode of Morning Glory is coming to you live from the Radio Sai studio where the time right now is 41 minutes past 9 a.m. Indian Standard Time. Today is the 18th of December 2014 and the current weather conditions in the abode of Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba are pleasant, pleasing and picture perfect. Daytime temperature 28 degrees Celsius. Overnight lows in the late teens. Clear blue skies, pleasant breeze and plenty of sunshine make this a dream destination for the upcoming holiday season, not only for the great weather, but more for the internal climate change that the heart and the mind experience in the precincts of this sacred space. Preparations for this year's Christmas celebrations are underway here in Prashanti Nilayam and Team Canada has already begun its descent into the ashram. It appears as though even Santa could not resist the wonderful weather conditions here in Prashanti Nilayam, so much so that he seems to have moved his workshop from the North Pole to the North Block of Baba's Ashram, where the Canadians are working round the clock, putting together Christmas wreaths, star-spangled banners, colorful lights, angels, poinsettias, and holly. And across from the shopping complex is the Satsang Hall, where these days you can hear melodious carols from the members of the International Sai community who are practicing there for the big day, the day that celebrates the advent of the Son of God, Jesus the Christ. True to Bhagwan Baba's ecumenical vision, Prashanti Nilayam celebrates the glory of the one and only God through every joyful opportunity, be it Christmas, Eid, Shivratri, Buddha Purnima. We have a packed multi-faith calendar of events that our multi-faith and multinational congregation celebrates here around the year. From the echoes of Joy to the World and Silent Night to Mrityunjaya Namah Om to Allahu Akbar to Buddham Sharanam Gacchami, the Prashanti Symphony captures every possible strain of the human aspiration to connect with God. As Baba says, paths are many, goal is one. Religions are many, God is one. With love, we offer our salutations at the lotus feet of such a master who taught us that we are all the same on the inside despite the external differences, who taught us that there is but one language, the language of the heart, that there is only one religion really, it's the religion of love. And seeking his blessings, I'm delighted to present to you the nourishment for your soul that I have lined up on Morning Glory today. A tryst with divinity interview with a man who has been all over the media lately. Eric Robertson recently co-authored a book with the well-known Mr. Brian Tracy, which hit the Amazon bestseller list. The book, Transform, the world's leading entrepreneurs and professionals get to the heart and soul of transforming your life, business and health, was released in September of this year, that is 2014, and it reached the bestseller status in two categories on Amazon.com. And Eric Robertson contributed a chapter titled, Combining Successful Parenting and Business. So this interview really is an interesting one, And I hope you will find enough reason when you listen to it to send in your feedback. Here it is for your inspiration and listening pleasure. And just in case you want to check out details about Eric Robertson's achievements, you can Google him, but just keep in mind his name is spelled E-R-I-K, not C. E-R-I-K Robertson. So please enjoy.
Sairam, dear listeners, on behalf of Radio Sai, this is Karuna Munshi welcoming you to another episode of Tryst with Divinity. Tryst with Divinity is our ongoing series of conversations with Baba's devotees from around the globe. Today is June the 20th, 2014, and I have the honor of welcoming Mr. Eric Robertson of the Netherlands to the Radio Sai studio for a Tryst conversation. An educational psychologist by profession, Mr. Robertson has been visiting Prashanthi Nilayam yearly since 1997 and often more than once. And since the year 2011, he has been living here in Prashanthi Nilayam for several months at a time. He has co-developed and given workshops on a mentoring pilot at the Sri Satya Sai Institute of Higher Learning in Prashanthi Nilayam. Eric Robertson can well be described as a serious SSEHV student and scholar, as he is very well trained in the Sri Satya Sai Education in Human Values from both the UK and the Netherlands, and has attended every possible workshop on the subject. And he has made some real progress in taking Baba's character education model mainstream in Europe and elsewhere. For example, in the Netherlands, he has contributed towards the development of a teacher training program for human values parenting. He has represented the Netherlands for a European Union project, that is an EU project, sharing best practices with institutions in the UK and Turkey. Eric Robertson has also translated Ms. Carol Alderman's SSEHV books into Dutch. Last year, he published Oops, the Parenting Handbook for the General Public. In India, it is to be launched as Oops, Toolkit for Parents. Both versions take Bhagwan Baba's values-based nurturing and parenting model to the general public. In addition, another important milestone in Mr. Eric Robertson's career coincided with the recording of this interview. I'd like to read for you a press release dated June the 18th, 2014 from Orlando, Florida, from the US. It says, and I quote, "Author and educational psychologist Eric R. Robertson has joined noted business development expert, best-selling author and speaker Brian Tracy, along with a select group of world's leading experts, to co-write the forthcoming book titled Transform: The World's Leading Entrepreneurs and Professionals Get to the Heart and Soul of Transforming Your Life, Business and Health." On that happy note, I'd like to welcome Mr. Eric Robertson to Radio Sai. Sairam brother, and a very warm welcome and congratulations to you.
Sairam sister, thank you very much.
So brother Eric, I understand that even though you were not raised religiously, you experienced a spiritual hunger at an early age, which led you to study Zen, Buddhism, Taoism and Hatha Yoga. But the defining moment came in 1997. What exactly happened?
Yes, that's very true. I was graced by Swami's good fortune. He appeared in a Dutch TV show where they did a documentary style program on the Bhagavad Gita, and they also talked about Satya Sai Baba. And I was completely enamored immediately. So I had a friend who told me to go and see a psychic because I had some questions about my life. And I went to see this humble lady who was doing a normal job at that time, and she had a big picture of Swami on the desk. I did not know consciously that this was Swami.
This was a Dutch lady,
and I remember looking at the picture and thinking, oh, there you are again. You know, there was this instant familiarity. And
where was this?
This was in a city in the south of the Netherlands, in a little town called Breda. And I remember being instantly touched, and that was the first appearance he made, and I didn't really give it much thought. It's like if, you know, on the street you run into somebody you remember from school, you know, forgive me for the comparison, because obviously Swami is his unique divine stature, and there's this familiar, very comfortable feeling. Then Dutch television did a show on the Bhagavad Gita, and they also portrayed Satya Sai Baba. So then I got very excited about that. So then slowly, whenever I'd go somewhere in the Netherlands, his books would pop up miraculously in the most unusual places. So there'd be a flea market, suddenly I'd be browsing through the books, one book would be there, so I'd start to read that. And then I'd go somewhere and people would say, oh yeah, I have a book of Sai Baba. And like this, slowly he started to become more prominent in my life.
And then began your journey to Parthi. He became prominent enough to inspire you to take a trip to India all by yourself?
Yes, indeed. And it was preceded by a visit to the UK, to a little town called Glastonbury. And I arrived there on New Year's Eve. And so I was aware of Satya Sai Baba. I had his books, I had his picture in my home. I hadn't gone to any centers and nothing of that kind yet. And then in the UK on New Year's Eve in Glastonbury, I looked for a bed and breakfast. And I think I saw about 6 different bed and breakfasts on that day. And it was getting dark and, you know, late in the evening. And in New Year's Eve in Europe, everything closes down. And I didn't like any of them. It didn't feel right. And I remember I kept looking and looking. Suddenly I drove down this little street and I saw a huge sign saying Sri Satya Sai Baba, center of Glastonbury, UK. And of course I had goosebumps. I started crying. I was very happy. And so I rang the doorbell and they actually had a bed and breakfast.
Oh.
And so I ended up staying there. So this
center, the Sai Center.
This was the Sai Center. And so this explained why all the others I didn't feel right. And, you know, one after the other was rejected.
And may I ask how old you were at that time and what you were doing in your life?
This was approximately, if memory serves me well, in 1997. And age-wise, I have to do some maths in my head, but I was somewhere in my early 30s. And I remember watching a video of Swami and sitting there meditating in the shrine room. And as happens to so many of us, I immediately thought, this is it. I have to go to Parthi. You know, there's no waiting, no delay. When can I get a plane ticket?
And professionally, what were you doing?
I had just studied educational psychology. I never wanted to study because I thought that was very, I was quite a rebel. You know, I thought that was very traditional and a waste of time. And, you know, it was better to work, I thought.
I see. <laughs> And I noticed that your spiritual interests are so varied. But I guess one thing that explains that is the fact that you grew up all over the world. Your parents were diplomats?
Yes, my parents were diplomats. So when I was 2 months old, we moved to Japan. Then we moved to Norway. Then we moved to West Africa. Then we moved to Netherlands. Then we moved to U.S. So I feel at home everywhere.
You're truly a citizen of the world.
Yes.
That's so interesting.
Thank you.
So tell me about your first visit to Puttaparthi. What was that like for a young Dutch seeker to arrive in an ashram? And what unfolded?
Well, as you say, indeed, I was brazen and perhaps foolish enough and hopefully brave enough to make the journey on my own. Whereas in hindsight, you know, everybody I would tell this, they'd say, why didn't you go with a group? You know, why didn't you get guidance, etc., etc.? And this was painfully brought home because I remember landing in Bangalore, and at the time I was on a very tight budget, and I made the foolish mistake of taking a local bus.
Oh, whoa.
So as we all know, those stop almost everywhere. And I probably was about a 9-hour ride without food or water. So I must say I arrived in Puttaparthi happy, but rather disheveled and, you know, worse for wear and tear. And as was custom in those days, I was allotted a room gracefully with 3 other boys. And so started my time in Puttaparthi. And of course, as you know, for us foreigners, it's a huge adjustment, even if you're used to traveling. And as Swami does with all of us, he has his time, right? And it's his program and his love and his home and his everything. So I must say I had 3 weeks and didn't really happen for me. So I was in the last few days and I was getting a little panicked because all my roommates were completely in bliss. They'd been coming for many years. And for me, it was just very tiring, very difficult. The schedule was very difficult. Dietary problems, you know, the whole thing. And I remember one day I was sitting in those days when we would just go in the main entrance. After Swami would go in for interview, we could actually move up. So the non-VIP gents could move up, and the dais would be sloping, and we could actually sit halfway up on the hill, so to speak, right in front of Ganesha and where Swami's chair would be. And I remember he'd just gone in, and there's a bhajan, and please correct me, but I think it's something to the extent of Anahi Padega Baba, Anahi Padega?
Anahi Padega Baba.
Anahi Padega.
You will have to come, it's like, you have no choice, but you have to come.
Exactly. Thank you. So I kept singing that in my mind, and even also a little bit, you know, quietly out loud, and I really felt it. You know, it's on the one hand, it's our ego, but it's also our spiritual learning. And I really thought, look, I've come all this way. This is the end route of my existence, and I'm not feeling the love. I'm not seeing you. You're apparently not talking to, you know, the whole thing. And I was singing this very fervently. He'd just gone in for an interview. The interview door room opened. Swami came out, made a beeline towards me, stopped in front of me, looked at me, gave me his, you know, Shiva, Maya, piercing, loving grace like a million fathers, a million mothers. And there are no words to express it except I was so deeply, completely overwhelmed. I had come home. You know, it's the soul meeting the oversoul. It's the divine marriage. I get goosebumps just speaking about it. And he turned back on his heels and he ran into the interview room, and that was it.
And you were reduced to a puddle, huh?
Yes, of course. I was crying. Couldn't stop crying. And even now, 17 years later, truth be told, I always am reduced to tears in bhajan or in videos or with the performances, because there's so much love. There's just so much love of Swami for us. There's so much love, you know, we feel for him. And yes, it's changed my life forever, obviously.
And subsequent to this, you have been coming here regularly and you have had a lot of interactions and experiences
yes.
with Bhagwan. It would be wonderful if you can just, you know, rewind and share with our listeners some of the highlights of your experiences with Baba.
Sure. I suppose that, first of all, to start with, after this experience, I remember standing on the hill next to the meditation tree, and in those days there wasn't a lot of shrubbery, so you could actually see all of Prashanthi Nilayam. And I remember thinking, I finally come home. I do not ever want to leave this place. I remember thinking, life in the West, you know, I watched the movie in my mind's eye, and I thought, really, this has zero meaning. Please let me stay. And of course, as well, he has done every single time. He kicked me right out at the end of my 3 weeks, you know, because he wanted me to go to the West and, you know, do whatever I needed to do. I think one of the main things which Swami does and has done for me is that he is, like he does perhaps with all of us, you know, the journey has really been one from the visible to the invisible, and from the material to the immaterial. And I recall one journey, if I may start with that, where 2 years ago I came here in November, and I'd started, by Swami's grace, to do a little work regarding a mentoring pilot with the Institute.
Right.
And, you know, they'd said, well, please, you know, I'd said, I'll come back for beginning of November for birthday. And he said, oh, yeah, because we plan to do a whole series of workshops then. And I recall that I arrived in November, and I waited for November, December, January, and I think finally in February, the first talk started.
Oh,
so we started the talks with Institute staff about, you know, how do we fit in this mentoring pilot with all the existing guidelines and regulations.
And you were patiently waiting?
Well, at times, and obviously, you know, it was quite a test for the patients.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the last day before I left, we finally had the workshops for a big group of the staff. And this brought in such an important lesson, actually two. One being, all is his time. So I thought it was to start in November, and it came at the last day in February. And the second is, as you say, patience. You know, really, we have to learn patience. And beautiful as it was, you know, it's a really good lesson in not living from your mind, you know, because the mind goes, oh yeah, we're going to do this first week of November. And I thought, oh, I'll go to the Himalayas, and I'll go here, and I'll go there. And I stayed here for 4 months waiting. But it was worth it.
And it must have been quite an inner process to wait for 4 months.
Yes, a huge inner process. Mm. And I'm very grateful. Mm. Yes.
So let's talk about any one-on-one that you've had with Bhagwan.
I would say to start that Swami has made his omnipresence and his, you know, divine motherly fatherly love known in so many little ways. And as I think back, like many people, just start with that, I was smitten with interview fever. I had interview fever and I had a ring obsession. So,
dangerous melodies.
Yes.
Very
yes.
contagious as well.
Yes, very contagious, as you say. So this would not only be, you know, hanging in the air, but I had read probably nearly every book that was written by Westerners, and, you know, invariably most Westerners would have an interview and or, you know, jewelry. And Swami really played with me on that one. So I think the first 10, 15 years, every single person I would meet would have either had an interview or a ring or both. So that was quite a joke. But at the same time, it was very sweet because all these people would share that divine love with me. So it almost felt like I was there the whole time. You know, there would be times where I'd even get up in darshan, you know, and as we do with our mother, you know, I'd say, Swami, please, you know, interview. And sometimes he'd just smile, and other times he'd say, yes, you know, how he could say this 10 times in a row. And I suppose after the first experience I shared with you where he really looked at me very closely, he started dealing with my fear. And one fear I developed, I love animals, but mother was afraid of snakes, and so I became afraid of snakes. I internalized this. And so every single time I came here, there was something with snakes. First time I drove into Patti after this first visit, the next time, somebody stopped the car and put a cobra on the hood. You know, the windows were open, so the cobra started approaching, you know, the windows, and there weren't electric windows in those days, so we were quite fearful that the cobra would come in the car.
Why? Was it a snake charmer trying to amuse you?
Exactly. Apparently it was a snake charmer, and, you know, we were quite fearful, so we were, you know, screaming at the driver to close the windows, and, you know, the cobra is coming closer, and finally we managed to close the windows, and as we drove off, he said, oh, don't worry, said the driver, because they take out the poison tooth, so it's not poisonous. And I felt rather foolish, and I said, oh, that was just Swami tricking us, so there's nothing to be worried about. And he said, no, on the contrary, because he said, sometimes the man is drunk, and he gets so angry, he throws the cobra into people's faces or laps. So you know, we were rightly on guard, you know, so it's always a lesson also in life to try and stay calm, but also take appropriate action. I remember one time where I was worried whether I should stay in Holland or not. And Swami would always take my letters. At this point, pens weren't allowed. Paper wasn't allowed in the ashram for security reasons. And so what happened is that at the last moment before he was going to come out, I thought, oh, I have to write Swami a letter. So I ran out, got a letter paper, started writing him a long letter, came back in, and in those days I'd wear the Indian Punjabi, the kurta outfit.
A pajama and kurta?
Yeah, outfit. And as I was sitting there, I thought, no, this is really very foolish. I don't have to write Swami. And, you know, he knows the minute we write it or think it. So I hid it in the folds of my
kurta.
And so Swami passed, and he passed me, and you know how he's an expert at seemingly ignoring us. And then 3 steps to my left, he came back, and he backed up, and he beckoned with his head. You know, he made this up-moving movement, like, give me the letter, right? So it's very sweet. You know, just very small things like that, but which really make us feel his divine presence. And his brilliance, one time I remember I was really thinking a lot about Christianity. You know how it is when we come to Patti. Swami is the one who decides. It's not us. He programs whatever needs to be programmed. And I had nothing to do with Christianity, I thought. I loved Jesus very much. I can share a small anecdote about that later. And I remember Swami stopped 3 seats to my left, and he asked the brother, what is the meaning of Christianity? And obviously he had nothing. He was like, when Swami talks, he had nothing to say. And then he passed me, and exactly 3 seats to my right, he manifested this beautiful cross in gold and diamonds. So it was like a real cross, but the whole size, length of the finger, and then with diamonds, you know, all the way across. It was very beautiful, very rare ring. You know, we've seen many rings. This one I've never seen. And I kept, you know, I was thinking about Christianity the whole day, and I felt very befuddled. And my colleague, conference sisters across the street from where we were sitting, you know, across the path, they had been watching all of this. And we came out, they said, what was going on, Eric? You know, you looked very, very befuddled, but very happy. And I said, you know, I'm thinking about the cross the whole time, and this is what happened. And they were all smiling. They said, don't you understand? And I said, no, what? And they said, well, Swami made a perfect cross, and you were in the middle. Oh. He stopped 3 seats to your left. He crossed you, then 3 seats to your right, he made the ring, and you had been working on the cross the whole time. And at that instant, it was completely resolved for me. So, you know, just little things like that we cannot comprehend. And this, they all seem to agree on this. So I don't think this was my own monkey mind. You know, they were very clear about this. And, you know, I'd walk through the ashram and suddenly I'd hear Swami say, oh, but sometimes you have to look up, you know, and I was walking in the ashram garden, there's a huge snake hanging right above my head in a tree. So, and one after darshan, I'd get a little scooter and I'd go out driving, you know, right outside the village. And the scooter would stop intermittently, so it wasn't very safe. And I looked up and right ahead of me on this clear road was this huge black cobra. I mean, enormous. And I was driving about, you know, 40 kilometers an hour, and I thought, what should I do? Because this thing keeps stopping. I thought, if I stop, it might not start again. And if the cobra has a bad mood, you know, maybe that's not very safe. And strangely enough, I decided to drive past it, which is not very logical, but that's what I decided. So as I'm driving past it, I can see the cobra turning with its head raised, with its hood raised, very close to my legs, mind you, barefoot and all. And I think at that moment I must have panicked. I must have, you know, left my body. And the next moment I passed and I looked back and it was gone, which was very strange.
It wasn't on the road anymore?
It wasn't on the road anymore. And, you know, I'm not prone to hallucinations or anything, you know, so Swami must have put it there. That's the only thing I can think of.
So have you overcome your fear of snakes?
Well, yes, there were a few more. And slowly, gradually, one day somebody gave me a card of Vishnu. And you know, with a
Vishnu on the Shesha.
Yes, okay. Vishnu on the Shesha, thank you.
Reclining on the big snake.
And finally, then it started to change. Because I'd always been very enamored with Shiva and Krishna, but nothing really was there in my consciousness. And suddenly there was this awareness of, oh, okay, that's you too, you know, and it's very good and it's okay. And after that, it pretty much stopped. But it was quite a process.
And Swami says Vishnu confers fearlessness.
Interesting. Right, yes.
So it must have been quite a churning process to bring this fear to the surface and deal with it and overcome it.
Yes. Mm. Even once I was having a massage at Ayurvedic spa after the ashram, and this huge snake crashed into the massage room. Same thing. You know?
They were looking out for you. They were looking for you everywhere.
Yes, indeed. Mm. Yes.
Very interesting. So the maladies, the fever that you were smitten with for a ring and an interview, how did that go?
It just, like Swami weans our bad qualities slowly but surely, it just disappeared, and he would shower so much love. Once we were singing with a Dutch choir, there's a Dutch Seva choir, and we were singing here for Guru Purnima. We sang in Purnachandra Auditorium. And he just did the sweetest things. Like he came out and he came to me and he said, "Are you the singers?" And you know, not like he sometimes jokes in us, but he really said, "Are you the singers?" I said, "Yes, Swami." And then he said, "How many?" And the group had kept changing. Sometimes we were 49, sometimes we were 52. You know, people would come and go. So I wasn't very sure, and I looked at the chap next to me and I said, "Was it 50 or 51?" And Swami interrupted me very sweetly and he said, "52. And he, you know, and he moved on, and, you know, just very, very small, gentle things like that. And at some point, I was very much wishing I could go and live somewhere else. I was not very happy in the Netherlands. And so Swami came to me in darshan, and he said, "Where are you from?" And I said, "Holland, Swami." And he smiled, and he said, "Where are you from?" And I said, "Holland, Swami." And, you know, the thing is, when Swami talks to us, you say whatever he wants to say, and your mind goes blank. And interestingly enough, the third time he again said exactly the same, "Where are you from?" And I again, to my horror and amazement, said, "Holland, Swami." And he said, very, very happy, very happy. And he moved on. And so he had answered the question that was so strongly in my mind, which is, where can I go and can I leave? You know, because in hindsight, my mind said, "Oh, I should have said something smart, like from you, or this, or that, and the other." And three times he made me say, "From Holland, Swami." And if it had been the wrong answer, I'm sure he would have frowned, scolded me, been very angry. But he was very sweet. And so, you know, there were so many little interactions like this, which were so moving. I had a beautiful dream once, and he's like this with all of us. You know, he's our closest love, and there's no difference. You know, like he always says, he says, I'm in you, you're in me, know this and be free. And that really healed all of the interview fever and the rings and everything. Just, yes.
Well, Swami said, interview is way more important than interview.
Yes, that is so true, so true. And I once had a dream and there was this huge hall and I was dancing in front of Swami. And then I was the only one dancing. And then at some point he lifted his skirt and he started to give birth to a baby. And I walked over and I helped him birth the baby, and that was the end of the dream. And to me it was very significant on several levels. One is that I had very few dreams of Swami. And because I work with parents and I work with children, it had a significance on that level also. But it was very beautiful, it was very profound.
What did the baby look like?
I don't recall, if anything, a Krishna-like baby, but it was just, you know, it stopped at that moment. It was just a beautiful, real baby.
Mm-hmm. That brings me to my next question.
Yes.
You have, as an educational psychologist, you obviously took to SSCHV like a fish to water,
yes.
And you've been very passionate about such
yes.
education and
yes.
human values,
yes.
and you've incorporated that into your profession and what you do.
Yes.
And now you are guiding a lot of parents through your work about value parenting.
Yes.
So I guess the baby, the child, the birthing was a symbol of what was to come.
Yes, indeed.
How did this journey towards being an author or a coach or a mentor or an expert, so to speak, on Sai parenting and values education begin?
It started by actually meeting a second psychic, and I don't see psychics, but I did see two psychics, you know, back in the 90s, because I was still unclear about what to do in life. She was a doctor, she was a very wise woman, and she looked at me and she said, oh, you have to go to university immediately. And I thought, oh, that rings true. And so I went to university and I thought, well, what should I study? And I wanted to be a doctor, but I was not very good in maths, and maths is a prerequisite, of course, for studying medicine. So I thought, well, I better do something else. And then I thought, well, I really love children, so I'll go and study educational psychology. And that's how that came about. And I got my master's in 3 years and 3 months, which is pretty quick. I was in a rush. And I thought, oh, I should at least become a professor, because then I'll learn something. Because I didn't feel I really learned anything at all, respectfully, other than, you know, little academic knowledge. And at that point, I started working. I thought, well, I better work. You know, life is short, it's better. I do service, and I really want to help people. And Swami brought me here. And then the first educational conference, one of the first was Paldal. He had Dr. Paldal. He had a 3-day conference on human values parenting. And I think I learned more those 3 days than I did the 3.5, you know, 3 years, 3 months. Yes. So I was very grateful. You know, I was very inspired. And I thought, okay, this is it. You know, I'm getting goosebumps as I talk about that. This is really it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, as you said, Swami brought me here for nearly every single educational conference. And then by His grace, I started doing different work in Netherlands, working for different institutions, NGOs, working with parents, people from all walks of life, working with, you know, people who are mentally challenged, physically challenged, or both, you know, people with drug abuse, physical abuse, all kinds of violence, all kinds of problems. And slowly but surely, at some point, I had my own practice. I did the EU work, and I decided to write a little book about the parenting. And my ego wanted a big book, and only a small book came out, which has been proven to be very good against Swami's insight and foresight, because parents say, we love the book and it's so short. We don't have time to read this huge, you know, treaty. And it's, you know, they feel supported and inspired and loved. And Swami specifically said, you know, not it's for the general public, because there are excellent books on parenting.
How did Swami tell you that? In how did
Inside.
Inside.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, it's written for the general public,
yes.
And you have sourced, basically it's based on Swami's teachings.
Yes.
Does his name figure in the book?
Yes, I quote him once or twice in the Institute. But you know, obviously I wanted to write very, very passionately about the Institute and about his teachings, and every time in so many ways he'd tell me no. And it became very clear, and now it's proven to be quite accurate, because there's such a need amongst the general public. You know, there are excellent books already on parenting available in the bookstore. So it seems it's all his divine planning, yes.
I see.
And human values, I write about human values as well in the book, of course.
Yes. And how are parents receiving this book?
Very well, thank you. Yes, they love it very much.
Good feedback, good reviews.
Yes, yes, thank you, Swami.
And good royalties.
That I hope with the Indian book, that'll be the first, the book in the West I'm self-publishing. So that's really just a matter of investing and being patient. And then hopefully with the Indian book, yes.
You're hoping, which is going to be published next month.
Yes, exactly.
Now, I have a question. This is a question that's on my mind, which I'd like to ask a lot of people that we get to interview here. I was reading your biography that was put out by the Celebrity Press, and this is a little bit of a sensitive question, so please allow me to ask. The press release says in your bio that recently Eric co-developed a mentoring pilot at one of India's most prestigious international universities. So obviously this is a reference to the Sai University.
Yes.
But the name of the Sai University doesn't appear there. Is that a conscious decision? And if so, why?
The thing is that for instance, in my book, I quote Swami and the Institute by name. But sometimes what happens in the West, and you know, as you said, this is a very sensitive issue. There are times where even the Sathya Sai Institutes in Europe or the zonal coordinators even advise against using the name, regrettably, because there is a lot of, you know, the wrong informed press. And so there are times, regrettably, not just for myself but other people, it causes more problems than it does good. So at the appropriate moments, it's used, and sometimes it's not used. And I you know, I feel bad because, you know, the Swami is my everything, and you know, all the institutes and everything he does is, you know, totally excellent.
Now, the book that you're going to co-author with Brian Tracy,
yes.
do they know entirely about your background and involvement with the Sai movement, the group of eminent people that you're going to be joining hands with to write this book, Transform?
Some do and some I haven't met yet. So you know, whenever we talk about it, sure, surely I talk very happily about the Institute, yes.
And what are their feedback or reactions to your mention of Baba or the Sai University?
There are various reactions. Some people will know it and they say, oh yes, I've heard of it, and I'll go on about, you know, the hospitals and all the great work and all of that. And then there are some people who have read or heard, you know, untrue negative things, and there'll be a negative reaction. And there's some people who haven't heard it all and they say, oh, just, you know, true American style, say, oh great, wow, that's great. You know? Yes.
I see. You know, it's strange how people like to hang on to negative news more than positive.
Yes.
And when it comes to Bhagwan Sri Sathya Sai Baba, for the millions and millions and millions who have benefited by his presence on earth.
Yes.
In his recent most avatar, as Sri Sathya Sai Baba, they're just some stray people who have always something negative to say.
That is so true. And you know, from my work professionally, we learn that whatever illusions, you know, hold on to us, even as quote-unquote, you know, normal people, how pernicious and how the veil of Maya, you know, how strong it can be, certainly for people who are not at all graced to be on the, you know, spiritual path, at least, you know, seemingly, at least not explicitly, implicitly, we're all on the spiritual path. You know, modern media has a very strong hold, be it this subject, be it any other subject. And indeed, as you say, there's this strong obsession for negativity. But I do feel very positive, because I do feel that not only regarding Bhagwan Baba, but regarding the world as a whole, we're in a huge transition phase. I feel we're moving to such a beautiful, joyous era, as Swami has announced so many times, where people will realize their own innate divinity and you know, their own freedom and their own power and strength also.
I see. It's nice to hear of your optimism. But as a psychologist, why do you believe what Bhagwan stands for is important for a complete, fuller understanding of the human nature or the human condition?
Hey, how long do we have? Because that will take a few days.
So today, yes, we'll just do a synopsis.
Sure.
Your opinion.
It's an excellent question, and my mind is racing trying to come up with an eloquent answer. Well, there are different things. Swami and Sathya Sai Baba is everything, all knowledge, all wisdom, all love, all truth. And as several eminent psychiatrists, for instance, like Samuel Sandweiss and other people who have been with Swami have shown so clearly, Swami knows absolutely everything about everything, which means also the field of psychology and, you know, psychiatry. and I say it with the S-A-I in you know, both spellings. And so all of his knowledge about the human condition is to be found in any psychological direction, you know, in any treatise, any analysis. And more importantly, to bring it really to make it very practical, what I found in my work by Swami's grace is that, you know, what I call the love and law or the love and tough love model works wherever I go. So all the teams I've been allowed to work with, you know, any healthcare professionals, be they psychologists, psychiatrists, nurses, doctors, pediatricians, they have so much knowledge, and yet, respectfully, notwithstanding all the great work that they're doing, there are so many problems in their client population. And what I find time and time again is when I apply Swami's love and law and Swami's human values, it solves almost everything. And it's beautiful to see. It's beautiful to see. So you see not only the healthcare professionals on the one side feeling empowered, feeling loved, feeling very clear about what they need to do, because there's a huge confusion among that group. And on the other hand, you see the clients, to call it that way, or the patients, and they all respond beautifully. So you see clients and patients who are previously, they've been diagnosed and labeled and treated in a not very flattering and very derogatory manner that you would not do with somebody who is also divine. And then when you apply love and law, you suddenly see them blossom and you see them doing things and coming with changes in their lives nobody could have imagined.
Now, as the author of the Parenting Toolkit, what advice would you give Psy parents who are grappling with the issue of raising teenagers, tweens, or even younger children who are so influenced by the media, yes, by peer pressure, yes, television, internet, that they're having a lot of problems maintaining a sense of semblance and discipline in the home,
yes,
and having the children focus on what is important?
That is an excellent question, and that is a question I've discussed with every single group of parents I work with. By Swami's grace, this last summer I was in the U.S. and this winter also, and I was doing online conference call workshops with the Sri Satya Sai Education and Values Coordinator in the U.S. It was very beautiful, and nearly all the parents would come up with issues you've talked about, which is related to peer pressure, the outside culture, drugs, sexuality, alcohol, you know, the whole modern culture that's being enforced through all the multimedia channels that are there. And it's hard to generalize, because really one-on-one I'd work with every family, and there'd be different issues underlying it. One thing that's very, very, very important is, again, love and law. So when the family has a very, very strong shield against those outside forces in terms of a very clear understanding and sharing and building of the human values that make their family important, so the uniqueness of the family has to be connected to Swami's values, the characters of that family, you know, the religious or whatever their backgrounds might be, and then there's to be constant communication with the teenagers about their lives. I strongly advise parental control in my book. I'm very strict about that. I say, look, as parents, you have to monitor everything. You have to monitor the cell phones if they have it. You have to monitor the internet use. You have to check every single thing, because you are their guardian. You are legally, morally, financially, emotionally, physically their guardian until they are 18 years old. This is a legal fact. And so anything that goes wrong, you are accountable. Swami always is very clear about this. So that's the one side. Because, you know, children and teenagers, they will stray. They are learning. Learning, you know, growing up as a teenager is about finding the right balance between being allowed to explore and yet also having boundaries. And so there has to be healthy give and take. And I always say, look, you give your children some freedom. If they show they can own it and that they are responsible, mature enough, then you give them a little more. You know, every day you give them an inch more to grow and to play and to explore. And every time if they show that they're worthy of that trust, the sky is the limit, because at some point, once they're 18 and they'll be going to college and university, and if they don't have the good fortune of going to Swami's college, university, all of a sudden everything will be there. All the temptations will be there. So you have to teach them to grow up, to be responsible, and to be able to basically manage themselves. And at the same time, you have to do that with infinite love. So you have to unconditionally love your child, love yourself, which is not the same as loving their behavior. So their behavior, you either approve or disapprove, depending on what's appropriate. And another thing which parents find very difficult, understandably, is peer pressure. Because the children come home and they'll say, "Mommy, Mommy, look, all the neighbor boys, they all have iPhones." And how difficult is it not at that point to acquiesce to that? However, what the parents need to realize is, first of all their peers are telling the same little ridiculous story to all the parents, and they're manipulating all the parents into believing something that's not true to begin with. Because it's a simple fact that not everybody can even afford this iPhone. And another good argument I always tell parents to say is, they say, look, you tell them, I have an iPhone, perhaps, right, or whatever phone, but look, I'm a 35 or 45, 55-year-old professional. I have earned and I need that for my work. It's not just something because modern media tells you that it's available that you should be having. And start to save for it. Mm. Get a Sunday job, Saturday job, save for it. Once you've earned it, okay, fair enough. Once, if I feel you need to have a mobile phone for me to communicate with you at a certain age, it'll just be a cheap prepaid phone. And only you'll be able to call me. There'll be no internet. If you are using that in a good way, then slowly we will build. And teenagers will give the poor parents a terrible time. They will tell them they're old-fashioned, they're horrible, they're mean, and all of that. And you have to let that storm pass. Because they don't mean it. They're just, you know, expressing this horrible pressure from modern, you know, media.
You talk of separating our infinite love as parents for our children from our approval or disapproval of their behavior. It's a very fine line to walk.
Yes.
How does a parent do that? Sometimes you mix up a child's behavior with who he is or she is.
That is so true. One of the reasons I wrote the book is to make a humble attempt at developing some consciousness about all of these matters. So parenting is really constantly about monitoring yourself, and as you say, every time trying to disentangle between that very fine line between sliding into approving or disapproving, or, you know, maybe not being strict enough or maybe not being loving enough. So it's constant management of yourself, really. And it's very, very difficult. There's no easy formula. It's, you know, like with any learning process, it's a lot of bruises and scrapes for all involved. But, you know, with Swami's love, it always works out. It really does. And being a good role model, obviously, of course, is always the best reminder. So parents, for instance, they'll be scolding the children for using their cell phones. Meanwhile, dinner, they'll be checking their messages. So, you know, simple things like that. And, you know, remind yourself, I cannot ask them to not use it if I'm using it. Things like that.
But a parent may attempt to be a good role model in his or her mind. However, for the child, that's like the most uncool personality to ever possess. And the child would consciously want to steer clear from any role modeling after the parent. In such a situation, what's the point of having a good role model? Because the role model a child is looking for is determined by music industry, by the movie industry, the entertainment industry, where like 16-year-olds are multi-billionaires overnight.
Yes, very true. Again, as a parent, you have to set a moral course. And that is very important. So you're asking a very good, tough question. And yes, you have to keep steering the course. And at the same time, I do try and tell parents, do try and at least imbibe some of those aspects that you just mentioned, maybe into your personality. You know, if you're very conservative, maybe go out with one of your teenagers and ask them advice on buying a nice pair of jeans. You know, something like that. Because as you say, if not, the discrepancy for the teenager the gap is too large.
Yeah, because they're living in two hemispheres,
yes.
Two separate hemispheres.
Yes.
One is the cool hemisphere of your friends and your peers and all your role models who are from the glamour industry. And
yes.
Then you have your old-fashioned parents who say, do this, Swami won't approve of that. You know, these are the boundaries. This is a vegetarian, very clean, sattvic household.
Yes.
So there are so many conflicting temptations and priorities that face a child. I'm guessing it must be very hard to be a teenager in today's world to begin with.
It is very hard. And as I said, it would take many days to really go in depth on the conversations I have.
Mm-hmm.
What I also do, and with Swami's grace, for instance, in Dubai, in the Sat Sai group, we've done it a few times. We've had a few hundred people from the Sai organization there. And we've had the parents and the teenagers and the youngsters all in one workshop. And that is really excellent, because what you find is that many teenagers have such a disrespect for any authority or anything that's more than, you know, 3 weeks old, so to speak. And so what I find is when you actually get all of them together, you get a very healthy process going, because if you do that respectfully, sure, there are things we can learn from our teenagers. And it's a give and take within the roles that everyone has. So the parent is still the authority, and the child is still the child, but has its own, you know, divine soul intelligence. And the teenager also has his or her own authority, because if they are very close to being 18 or 19, surely soon enough they'll be on their own in many cases. So you will have to honor their, you know, their, who they are becoming as a person in this modern culture, and yet you have to keep the dialogue open. So the most important thing is the communication. You have to keep speaking with each other, because I do see that if there's only the repression, as you say, if there's only the constant nagging and creating a gap, as you say, between that teenager's world and your own home, you'll lose them. So if you're on that sliding, you know, downhill path, all you can do is reach out and talk to them from your heart and keep inviting them to be able to talk to you. So, you know, truth is an important thing, you know, so the unconditional love for the person, but also the truth to say, look, if you feel that they're going somewhere they shouldn't be going, just say, at least talk to me. You know, if you have decided to do things that are not right, at least please keep communicating, because then you might be able to get them back. You know, or it might be a detour and you can get them back on track. Because if you only hit them with dogma, as we all know from, you know, numerous examples, you know, they go away. And you don't want that. You want the love to be there.
You speak of how people resist, young people resist only dogma. Now, if you notice, in the Sai organization, in the Sai families, we see a lot of children going through the Bal Vikas program or the SSC program. And by the time they hit the youth group and they move on to various universities to pursue higher education, we sort of lose them. And we lose them for a good 10 to 15 years till they finish their education, possibly get married and become parents themselves. And then they sort of start coming back to the Sai Center because they want to raise their children with Swami's values, yes, and so on. Now this deficit, this big break that happens in a person's journey where we lose these children in whom we invest, yes, 9 years of SSC. Yes. I've been a guru, yes, all my adult, yes, life. I know how much work that takes. If you have to run your program effectively and efficiently, it's a full-time commitment. And I really laud all Bal Vikas gurus and SSC teachers. I never take their contribution lightly, because it is lifelong commitment.
Yes, yes.
Now, after investing so much in a child who Swami has given you as your student and trying to love that child as Swami's gift to you, you nurture them, you nourish them, and you lose them. What can we do to bridge this gap? How do they fall through this net? Can we do something smarter, in your opinion? More engaging?
Yes, well, that's a very, very good, tough question again. First of all, you know, as you say, my deep respect for you and all teachers, which I always say is unparalleled, you know. What's important to realize, I think, for all teachers as yourself is, the incredible work you've done all those years, it's a foundation that always stays, no matter what the outer appearance is. So as you say, first of all, they end up coming back because suddenly they have children and they say, oh my goodness, what do I do now, right? And then they recall that, oh, I have these wonderful Bal Vikas teachers and, oh, that's where, you know, I'll find my anchor and I'll find the guidance I need. So don't underestimate and don't be fooled by appearances. So they might, as you say, fall out of the net, and anyways they do, sure. But they do come back. However, I'm trying to find the right words. I think one of the important things is that, as Swami also says, you know, don't walk behind me or in front of me, but walk next to me, be my friend. So what I find with teenagers is that I am their friend, really. And because of my own paths in life, perhaps by Swami's grace, the good and the bad of that have made me accessible in that sense. And for instance, you know, one great thing, and I'm sure you know this, what you can do is you just take their music, for instance. So you say, okay, let's listen to your music, right? What's on your player? So you listen to that, and you can do this in groups also. It works really well. You say, okay, what are they thinking? What are they singing about? And then what you find is that when you ask them to reflect on all their favorite pop music, that suddenly they also wake up. And they say, oh, that's a really good song, isn't it? Because it's about love and fortitude and courage and perseverance in whatever form might come, right? It might be atrocious for us to listen to, but nonetheless. And then there might be other songs, and they'll say, oh, well, either explicitly or implicitly, those are terrible values. What on earth are they singing about? And suddenly, by themselves, they'll stop listening to that song. Or, you know, you look at the video clips, which is quite a challenge, and you can do the same thing. So I find that little things like that or the word leveling with them, same thing with the movies, saying, okay, let's watch the movies, whatever you're watching. And then again, you know, awakening their own consciousness in that sense. And part of the struggle or the battle, if you will, is inevitable, it seems, because as you say, you lose them, they go into their peer groups, they join companies, as one brother was telling at the summer course of Indian spirituality, which was really magnificent, by the way, he was saying that he said, look, there's so much pressure, he came back, he's an MBA alumni, and he said, he was the only one not drinking. He said, everybody drank in the company, there was such pressure. But he said, he stood his ground, because he just told all his peers, he said, look, I don't. I go out with you, I'll have dinner, I'll do whatever we do, but I just don't drink. And slowly, after about 15 years, finally now he's getting the same respect. And they actually all come to him, because they feel that, you know, he is a steady pillar.
Sober one.
Yes, and the sober one.
Okay.
So, again, I hope I've not diverted too much, but it's very complicated, as you say. It's very complicated. I think also with the teenagers, and perhaps, as you say, as the teachers, maybe some conference we should sit together and really address this issue. Like, how do we bridge that gap between, let's say, anywhere between 17 to 35? You know, how do we deal with that? Because it's a big one. It's a very important one. We see the same thing in Europe. There's a lot of people leaving. And it's a pity, because, you know, it's not necessary. It's a wonderful family we have, so.
Very true. And you also see that a lot of Westerners who come to Prashanthi are either people who are maybe above 45 and 50 years old, or children.
Yes.
We don't see such a huge or a proportionate representation of young adults coming from the Western countries. Although I think last few years after the Mahasamadhi, we notice in the ashram a lot of people from Russian-speaking countries are coming, who are younger, who are young adults. But it makes you wonder, where is the in-between, the sandwich generation? We're missing one layer of the sandwich, in-between.
That is very true. Well, actually, in all, without any fake humility or pride, I wrote a book called Here It Is Always Thursday last year, and I submitted it to the trust, but I learned that the trust, since Swami's Mahasamadhi, has very strict rules on what they're allowed to publish. So I was told basically that they only publish, you know, teachers within Swami's fold and the institutes, universities. And so I'm thinking of asking Site House, see if they'd like to publish it. And basically, that's a book about my own life and experiences with Swami. And there's a huge invitation to that group you talked about to come here and actually come here and experience and see what a great place it is. Because, you know, there's a temptation of other gurus who are embodied. You know, we all know the names. And yet, this place is so much to offer. And there's actually a person from Persia I spoke to last Christmas in their 30s, and they'd never been here. And the father had been here in the 50s, had been totally enamored by Swami, brought home some pictures, came back to Iran at that time.
Muslim?
Possibly. I'm not quite sure. And
you spoke of taking pictures. I'm just wondering how safe was that.
Ah, right. Yes, it was quite dangerous in those days. And the family disapproved, so he put everything away in a little cupboard, and he passed away. And the children found these things, and they started looking at it, and one of the children decided to come to Puttu Bhakti. They'd never been here. So they were here at Christmas, and they were enjoying, you know, the wonderful energy of Prashanthi Nilayam. And yet they weren't quite, you know, they hadn't quite been smitten by the way we can be when Swami was here in his physical form, even though we feel his omnipresent love, of course. And one day they were late for darshan. They walked into the garden, and this lady came up to this person and said, come with me, I have to tell you something. Now, this person from Persia, the night before, had asked Swami three questions in their, you know, meditation. And this person who came up to them told them the answer to those three questions in the garden. And this person obviously was blown away. And the person told them, look, Swami came to me in my dream and told me to look for you in the garden and give you these three answers. So this shows how amazingly omnipresent Swami is and available for everyone. This person came here for the first time. They'd never known or seen Swami, and yet...
Interesting, because the demographic deficit that we are experiencing in the Sai movement is getting more and more pronounced, because we have such a huge number of Balvikas children and we have such a large number of adults, but we're missing the young adults. So I hope the gap gets filled.
I hope so too, and I do feel that hopefully as time passes, we have so many beautiful, inspiring conferences here, and I hope perhaps we can also try and see how perhaps we can attract, you know, how the ashram could attract that group.
Yes, and ways conferences we could have their worth, but the test of the pudding that is that when you go back and get back into your busy lifestyle and into your professional life and various commitments, social, family, how do people incorporate this? So basically, as I see it, it calls for a complete shift in priority, where you can integrate Swami as part of your everyday life, not an extra activity you do on the weekend and maybe on Thursday evening and then get on with the rest of your life. He has to become very much a part of your rest of your life.
Yes, that's very
if
true.
If we teach our children that, we can possibly make sure that there are no two hemispheres. The two hemispheres integrate and become one.
Exactly. You're so right. I am so happy to hear that. I feel the same way.
So, Eric Robertson, final thoughts. If I asked you, who is Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba for you, what would you say?
Love.
Nice, sweet answer. If Swami was physically sitting right here in this chair, which is his, in the studio, right now, what would you say to him? How would you react to his physical presence?
Well, even thinking about it, tears are in my eyes, and I always tell him, I love you so much, Swami. So.
It's all about love, isn't it?
Yes, very much.
Very interesting to talk to you. Much to learn from you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Sai Ram.
Sai Ram.
Tune into Sai.
Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Stay tuned. Sai Ram, and welcome back to Morning Glory on Thursday Live. We are coming to you live from the Radio Sai Studios in Prashanthi Nilayam, India, the seat of all auspiciousness, ultimate beauty and supreme truth. The time in the ashram right now is 42 minutes past 10 a.m. Indian Standard Time. Today is the 18th of December 2014 and you're tuned to our Asia stream. Good vibe to plug into, isn't it? Thanks, we enjoy your company too. By the way, did you enjoy the interview that we played for you, The Tryst with Divinity with Mr. Eric Robertson? Your thoughts, comments and suggestions mean the world to us, and we look forward to your feedback by email at listener@radiosai.org. Dear listeners, before we go any further, I have a confession to make. I had originally lined up a phenomenal Fleeting Moments interview for you, but sadly I don't have enough time to play it today, and I must finish promptly at 11 a.m. for Professor G. Venkatraman and his panel of experts to sign in. So I'm giving you a heads up for next week. Please note that I will bring you this interview that you must not miss. This is a very rare exclusive by my colleague, Mr. Bishu Prushti. Bishu's guest on the show is Mr. Sudhindran, a Sai University alumnus who served Bhagwan Baba right inside the Yajur Mandir. In fact, he lived inside the Mandir. You cannot afford to miss this interview. So please be on the lookout for this interview on Morning Glory, hopefully next week. And now I have a musical feast for you. Did you even know that the internationally acclaimed Bollywood singer, Miss Richa Sharma, has been coming to Bhagwan Baba since the age of 3, and that Bhagwan even performed the wedding of her sister right here in Prashanthi Nilayam? This year, on Ladies' Day, which is November the 19th, Richajeep offered an enthralling concert in the Divine Presence. And I will play you some highlights from that concert shortly. But I must also share with you my joy of interviewing her later that night on Ladies' Day. She was such a delight to have in the studio as she poured her love for Bhagwan through her words and the many songs that she sang for us throughout the conversation. Her voice is very powerful, and when she sang in the studio without any music, the purity of her notes was simply incredible. We had quite an audience, actually, of Mandir singers and other music lovers sitting in the studio just listening to that interview live. And that Radio Sai exclusive interview will feature in the near future on our special show called Love to Love. It's hosted by Radio Sai's Vijay Chandu at 2 p.m. on Thursday live on Asia Stream. And just so you know, today on the same show, that is Vijay Chandu's Love to Love, he's going to bring you a very special program, which is a mix of an interview and a live concert that Mrs. Kajal Chandiramani offered in the Mandir on November 18th. So please don't miss this episode of Love to Love this afternoon at 2 p.m. Indian Standard Time right here on Asia Stream. So, as I bid you a loving Sai Ram and I wish you a saisome awesome day ahead, here are some highlights from Richa Sharma's Ladies' Day concert of 2014 from Prashantinilayam. Please enjoy it, and till we meet next Thursday, Jai Sai Ram.
My koti koti pranam in lotus feet of Bhagwan Sri Sathya Sai Baba. I'm feeling so blessed to be here after 2 years. Thank you, Swami, for remembering me, for giving me your blessings. Sai Ram.
जन जन का कल्याण कल्याण प्रार्थना सुनिए श्री भगवान प्रार्थना सुनिए श्री भगवान कीजिए जन जन का कल्याण प्रार्थना सुनिए श्री भगवान
तेरे
डर के सिवा मौला। इस दुनिया पे तेरे करम का साया मौला, दामन कहाँ दर के सिवा मौला। मौला मौला मेरे मौला, मौला मेरे मौला, मौला मेरे मौला, मेरे मौला मौला मेरे मौला, मौला मेरे मौला, मेरे मौला मौला मेरे मौला, मौला मेरे मौला, मौला मेरे मौला, मेरे मौला मौला मेरे मौला, मौला मेरे मौला, मौला मेरे मौला, मेरे मौला करम हो करम, मेरे मौला करम हो करम, तुमसे फरियाद फरियाद करते हैं हम, मेरे मौला करम हो करम, मेरे मौला करम हो करम, मौला मौला।
Mola, mire, mola, caramba. मेरे मौला करम हो करम, मेरे मौला करम हो करम। गिरिधर बाल श्याम गोपाल नटवर लाल मदन
राम Sarambha, Priya Sai Gopali.